When you're planning that well-deserved holiday, you probably look at places that will have, where you will have the most fun. Islands with crystal cool beaches, bustling cities filled with exquisite architecture, or sites steeped in rich history. The communities who live in those places are of little consequence most of the time. But there is a practice called justice tourism, where people plan trips to place in order to economically uplift those places and partake in real cultural exchange. Tourism lecturer at the University of South Australia is on the line to tell us more. A very good morning to you, Freya Higgins.
Good morning, Reynaldo. Nice to be with you.
It's great chatting to you this morning once again. And I briefly mentioned what justice tourism is, but please give us the proper definition for someone who hasn't heard this term yet.
Okay, it is a new term in the tourism experience, and it describes using your tourism and travel choices to engage in work with a local community hosting you. And it includes things like addressing human rights education. It can be working on poverty alleviation with local communities. There are political solidarity tours and holidays that are working towards change in a destination to improve the lives of people. So there's a variety of options. If I could give you some examples that will perhaps come into focus a bit more. There's an organization in the United States called Global Exchange, which is a human rights organization, and they, for more than two decades, I think, have been doing human rights educational tours at places all over the world. And they cater to the international community, so their places include Guatemala, Nicaragua, Cuba, also the United States, inside the United States itself because there's human rights issues there, South Africa, India, and so, you know, destinations all over the world. Another example I'll give you are the solidarity tours which occur between groups that are working for communities. So Cuba has been a site of solidarity tours for decades. Palestine, which is the place that I've researched and worked with, is another site where solidarity tours happen. But to give you another example that shows that there's also an ecological focus, the Ladakh region has a great focus on their work, which is about ecological living. So the Ladakhi program, which is the International Society for Ecology, hosts people coming to Ladakh to learn from Ladakhis about their practices. And at the same time, it sees Ladakhi leaders being taken to places like London in the UK to perhaps see that the development strategies being undertaken in the developed countries aren't so sustainable and ecological in their focus. So that's a case of educational exchanges.
And when we talk about the type of people who partake in justice tourism, who would that be? How would you describe them?
Well, you know, the ones I'm talking about with Palestine, I don't know that those people would actually call themselves tourists. So my definition stretches for some of these. So you've got things like the International Solidarity Movement, which sees people from around the world go to Palestine and be, for instance, human protectors for Palestinian children trying to go to school in safety under occupation. Now, I'm calling them tourists because they use the same transport and travel technologies. And in fact, you know, they engage in some sightseeing in their off time and, you know, buy souvenirs. But, you know, they obviously think of themselves as human rights activists. So they're what I would call on the extreme end of the continuum, very committed and using their choices in travel opportunities for really powerful political and human rights activity. On the other hand, ordinary tourists will do it. So, for instance, again, I'll stick with Palestine, the Alternative Tourism Group based in Bet Sahour in the West Bank host visitors to do a half-day tour where you can experience Jerusalem from a Palestinian NGO leader's point of view. And then in the afternoon, you can be led by Israeli human rights organizations, such as the International Committee Against the Demolition of Housing. So that, you know, ordinary tourists book into. It doesn't cost a lot of money and it doesn't take a lot of time, but they're interested in the situation, so they want those educational opportunities. So there's a variety of people and a variety of types of tours and commitments that they engage in.
And when you take a look at the itinerary and what these tourists, if we can call the group that, do on these visits, you mentioned some of them actually do the sightseeing and they do buy some artifacts and stuff like that. Is this something that is a form of tourism that is extremely planned to the T? When you're going for 2 weeks, you know exactly what you're going to do? Or is it a case of seeing the situation and seeing where you can help out?
I believe that there's some people that know about the destination and they do actually plan it as part of their variety of activities and destinations. And there's some people that will learn about it when they get there and they'll fit it into their itineraries. So it's different types of people. I do want to say, though, that probably the bigger phenomenon, rather than this politically and human rights focus to this justice tourism, it is related to something that could be mistaken, and that I'll talk to you about because I think more people are doing this. Things like the slum tours and orphanage tourism, which are part of the volunteer tourism sort of niche of the tourism development. And a lot of people are doing these when they go to places like Rio. You've got the favela tours, or in South Africa, you have the township tours. Cambodia is really well known for really strong phenomenon in the past of visitors going to visit orphanages and engage with children. And they think they're doing good, but I think that this niche can be problematic. So one term I've heard from, you know, critics of it is it's poverty porn. So the question, you know, what are people going for, what are their motivations, comes into this, because how do you know the difference between what I described to you as the human rights tours versus these things? And it becomes a question that, you know, I think tourists and your listeners actually need to be reflective of what it is they're choosing to do. In places like in Cambodia, they've changed the legislation around visits, tourist visits to orphanages, because there's issues with child safety.
Yeah.
And there's issues even of exploitation of vulnerable young people who aren't actually orphans. So they get purchased basically to be assets for an orphanage to try to get funding from guilty-feeling tourists.
And many a times, talking about what we're discussing now, it looks like these tourists are trying to get rid of their guilt. And I can speak about it from a personal experience, because sitting in South Africa, I've known and I've always seen tour buses drive through the townships, and it leaves me a bit uncomfortable. Because
this question about motivations, is it rich people trying to alleviate their guilt?
So,
some research has said it's about curiosity, and it can be a chance for the tourist to reflect on how good their life is. So there's a bit of alleviation of people's existential crises, and that's not looking at the benefits of the local people. So I think how we know the difference would be to do an interrogation of what the tours are about. Are people there for actually contributing to solidarity? Are they respecting the local people? And does their visit actually lead to some positive outcomes? I did see something just in the news on a Native American website that's of interest here, where they were criticizing that the Facebook billionaire Mark Zuckerberg visited Blackfeet leaders in the U.S., and he was asking about life on their reservations. And that article, which was written by a really reflective activist, called that poverty porn. And he suggested that Mark Zuckerberg actually had good intentions, and the Blackfeet who were hosting him had very good intentions. But the thing that was overshadowed in this visit, when it got the media attention, was he said nothing about all of the great projects and leadership that the Blackfeet community were doing to change their own lives and, you know, programs for their own people. It was all about white savior sort of syndrome.
Yeah.
So I think this situation with the slum tours and the orphanages is is that what's going on, that you are the white savior coming in and gazing on poverty and then walking out?
Mm. You mentioned that, I'm not sure which country you mentioned, but there's legislation that's put in place just to limit this and essentially limit exploitation. Can you just remind me again what that country was and if there are any other countries who you predict or that you know of who will be implementing this? Because like you said, it's quite a tricky situation and it can become a case of straightforward exploitation.
That's right, and there is a problem with sex abuse, you know, with child sexual exploitation being used in these orphanages and other facilities like this, where Western tourists or rich tourists exploit the vulnerabilities of children in these things. So you get child protection laws being strengthened in countries. And then at the international level, you have activism. There's an NGO which was called in the past In Child Rights in Asian In Child Exploitation in Asian Tourism. Sorry, my words aren't coming out right, Ronaldo. ECPAT is the acronym of it still. And they have worked at the global community to make sure that around the world there's legislation to make sure that children are not abused and exploited in tourism. So they've got legislation in countries like here in Australia. If an Australian citizen abuses a child in a place like Cambodia, they can be prosecuted back here in Australia for that. And they're working on campaigns where hotels have training packages where the people are actually really skilled at identifying potential abuse happening. So it's happening at the state level and at the global level to deal with that problem. And then I think it's the tourist responsibilities to also think about what they're purchasing and what their choices are. So if you wanted a checklist from me about what justice tourism contributions would need to be, the questions I'd be asking people to ask themselves is, who controls the experience, who benefits from the experience, and whose voice is heard? So that's the point about this situation with Mark Zuckerberg. He could have been a conduit for Blackfeet excellence to be promoted. And, you know, do these tours actually show the skills, the capabilities, the projects, and the experiences in the communities visited, because people are doing amazing things to improve their own lives? And does the visit lead to solidarity and justice outcomes, you know, or is it just gazing on poverty and being this thing that we criticize as poverty porn?
And then the thing also with that is it continues to live with regards to the photos and blogs and videos people share on social media, and then we see this and then everyone thinks you did something wonderful and you experienced life, but like you said, you need to really take a look at who this benefits when you do take part in that.
When you come home, do you share what you've learned? You know, one thing about the Palestinian Solidarity Networks is the idea that people go to Palestine and learn, and then you come back to your own communities and you become advocates for peace and justice in Palestine in your home community. What I loved about the Ladakhi case, and there's several around the world like this, with the Ladakhi program actually saying Ladakhi have knowledge that outsiders can learn from, and at the same time you take the people of Ladakh to other countries so that they widen their horizons and they learn as well. Those kinds of reciprocal learning experiences and transformation, I think, are perhaps the most high-achieving, idealistic type of work that could be done.
On that note, I'm going to say thank you for this conversation. It's always a pleasure to chat to you. And best of luck with the rest of your day or your weekend. And I'll be sure to get you on the line soon to chat again.
I'd love it. Thank you so much.